Hi, this is Pei.
Hey, this is Joel.
And we are husband-wife team of Relaunch.
And you're listening to our good friends Daniel, Travis, and James on the Skate to Create podcast.
What's up? This is James, the creative director for Royal Deca and the host of the show.
What's going on, guys? It's Daniel, the co-host for Skate to Create and the project manager for Royal Deca. Like always, we want to stop and thank everyone for tuning in. We've got a great show today.
Yeah, and normally on the Skate to Create podcast, we're talking to industry professionals, in the skateboard industry. We talk to them about what's contributed to their success and what they've learned from skateboarding.
Yeah, just like, a lot of pro skaters and a lot of people behind the scenes of the industry,
Yeah, the show has a mission, and that's to extract helpful tips, tools, and resources that we can all apply, in our own lives and businesses. But today, we have a special interview, not with a skateboarder, but with someone that has a lot in common with skaters, and probably more than what, you or he might even think. Today we have Jeff Ulrich, who is the chairman of Midroll Media and co-founder and CEO of one of my favorite podcast networks, Earwolf. And just in case you don't know, Earwolf is a groundbreaking comedy podcast with, they've been dominating the new media world.
Right.
They have amazing shows. There's so many of them, and they all have their own spin on comedy. Jeff also hosted his own podcast on that network called The Wolf Den. Now, I studied this podcast. I tried to learn the ropes about podcasting when I was interested. I tried to learn about marketing and business and how they all connected, and that's exactly what he talked about in that show. Jeff is basically someone that I've really been wanting to talk to, and not only because of what he's done in the new media world, but because he's done it with no permission, no roadmap, and all in the right way. So we're so excited to welcome to the show Jeff Ulrich. What's up, man?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I hope I can live up to some of the expectation. I feel like a bit of an interloper as somebody who's got, no skateboarding experience. I had probably, some sort of a $10 board when I was maybe, 10 years old, and it caused me, several, trips to the nurse's office and stuff like that. Before I ultimately gave up and I collected cobwebs in my parents' garage.
Hey, you tried. Well, that's okay, Jeff, because we're not really here to talk about skateboarding with you, even though that's mostly what our audience makes up.
I think the good thing about this show is the knowledge. We have featured guests, had your buddy John Lee Dumas on the show, one of our newest episodes, just because of the information that he could bring to our audience. A lot of our audience has that creative talent and just probably doesn't know where to start, or if they started, how to take it to the next level.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of, maybe for these people, it's their first time hearing about you or Earwolf. If you don't mind, could you give us a little bit of a rundown as far as a little bit more about you and what you do now?
Sure. I started Earwolf with Scott Aukerman, who's the host of Comedy Bang Bang, which is both the first podcast that we had on Earwolf, as well as a TV show now on IFC, just started its fourth season. And Scott and I started the company back in mid-2010, just kind of, hoping to create an infrastructure that allowed podcasters to do their thing without worrying about all the details. And, it's weird because it was both a fairly modest endeavor, and at the same time, we did have some, I wouldn't say big plans, but we kind of had an idea of how we wanted to grow.
Right.
And I think that it's basically, people are like, so what did you start out wanting to do? And I was like, well, kind of what we did, which almost makes me feel like I did something wrong. Most of the time, you start something and then you wind up somewhere very different than where you intended,
right,
if it goes well. But you know, usually it's hard to do it the way you write it up on you know, the drawing board. But we were lucky, I think. You know, we actually were just talking about this. We feel like if we had started the company 3 months sooner than we did, or 3 months after we did, we wouldn't have had as much success as we've had. You know, we started the company with a small amount of money and no backers or anything. And, you know, at the time, it was a risky business, so to speak. And, you know, if we had started earlier than we did, we may have run out of money. And if we had waited, like I said, even like 20 months, we would have probably not had quite as much momentum before most everyone else, and it might have made it harder for us to do what we did. And so we just kind of feel like we were really fortunate to see an opportunity and to go to work on executing there when we did.
Yeah, and it seems like there was a lot of podcasts that started up earlier and just ran out of gas, you know, or whatever happened before. I can definitely see how timing played a part in that. Do you feel like the niche of comedy had a big part in that success, that early success?
Yeah, I do, but I mean, of course I'm biased. I think, you know, Leo Laporte from This Week in Technology would probably disagree with everything I'm saying, or maybe not disagree, but he would have his whole business to prove that it's not true. But I think, you know, you have comedians and you have technologists tend to be the first groups of people to try things. And especially in the entertainment space, comedians are always very anxious to figure out a way to, you know, use a new medium to create new content, to reach a new audience, to make the audience that they already have that much more connected to them. And I think that's why you saw the kind of comedy explosion be one of the first verticals to experience that.
Right.
You know, I don't want to bore everybody with like things that have been said a million times, but you know, the whole story with Marc Maron and why and how he started WTF is, I think, a pretty good microcosm for the whole space at that time, which
right.
is, you know, if you were a comedian and you weren't getting the phone calls that you wanted to get from the rest of the industry, then you could start a podcast and no one could tell you not to.
Right. And, you know, just in case anyone is interested in listening to a lot of those stories, you have several podcasts out where you're going into where you and Scott Aukerman actually started by, you know, convincing people, well, first telling people what podcasting was and convincing a lot of comedians that Scott was friends with to start their own podcast. And you talk a lot about that in your own podcast, The Wolf Den, and a few other ones that I've heard. But, you know, I wanted to bring you on to ask you some other specific questions because, you know, you've done a lot of different things back then, and then now you've moved on to stepping down from Earwolf in a way and picking up with Midroll. Can you explain what that was?
Well, actually, that's not what happened.
Oh.
So Scott and I started Earwolf, like I said, in 2010. And then I started a company called Midroll back in early 2013, which is a company that helps podcasters monetize their shows largely through advertising. So that company now represents, I don't know, like 180 or 190 podcasters, including Earwolf.
Right.
You know, shows like WTF with Marc Maron and Nerdist, Star Talk Radio with Neil deGrasse Tyson, Smodcast, John Lee Dumas' show, Entrepreneur on Fire, a lot of different shows across all kinds of genres.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I started that in early 2013 out of the opportunity that I saw in trying to monetize Earwolf. And again, you want to talk about kind of like good timing. you know, in 2012, there was enough interest in podcasts and enough success in podcasts that people started to expect to make a little bit of money. Not a ton, but make a little bit of money. And, you know, we were in the business of podcasting. We needed to make money to grow and to pay our artists and to hire people and all of those things. So I found myself, as most kind of young founders do, and I don't mean young in terms of age, I mean in terms of experience, found myself as like the chief salesperson for the company. There's no one better to sell your company and your products, your services than you are usually. And chances are you can't afford to hire someone to do it anyway.
Right.
So I did all the sales. You know, it really started from a partnership. I had, back in July of 2011, sorry, God, I'm turning into Mr. like war stories guy, but, I thought I was like the smartest person who ever lived. I really did, because I did a deal with Funny or Die where they put two of our episodes on their homepage, and not just like anywhere on the homepage, but like right below the fold. So it wasn't prime real estate, but it was the best real estate you could possibly hope to achieve as being non-Funny or Die content. And so we had two episodes always right below the fold. They paid us a licensing fee for the shows. And then we worked out a deal where their 9-person professional sales team was going to sell ads against our shows. I just thought that this was like the greatest thing ever, right? Everybody who goes to Funny or Die is going to want to listen to our podcast. You know, it's not like a typical biz dev relationship where maybe the fit isn't perfect. Like, this was perfect. Everybody who goes to watch Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis is going to want to listen to Zach on Who Charted or listen to him on Comedy Bang Bang. And for those people who don't know, Scott, my partner in Earwolf, he's the co-creator, writer, director of Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis.
Right.
But anyways, so you figure, like, it's a great synergy to use, like, a word that typically is a red herring and really, you know, typically synergy doesn't happen. And in this case, it didn't either. We converted, like, I want to say 0.3% of our traffic came from Funny or Die, which was tiny, way, way, way less than we anticipated. And I'm still friends with all of those guys today. The CEO of the company, Dick Glover, is a mentor of mine. But I can honestly say that, like, their sales team didn't sell much of our stuff. So as smart as I thought I was, thinking like, oh my God, these people, all they do all day is sell comedy or sell ads against digital comedy. They'll be able to do it better than me. I wound up selling like 96% of all of our ads during our 2-year partnership with them. And it's just hard.
I'm so glad you said that, Jeff. Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of times where you feel like someone else that's a salesperson or might be in the role already can sell your product or sell your idea or whatever. And like you said, often it's just you that's going to be the best suited for that.
Especially when something's different, you know, it's really hard to sell things that other people don't understand.
Right.
And the problem with hiring salespeople in that situation is that you wind, like, first of all, you know, it's like the Lake Wobegon effect, right? Everybody wants their kids to be above average. And so nobody's like, oh, I'm going to hire the bad salesperson. Like, get me the worst salesperson you can on the phone. I want to offer him a job. Like, nobody's ever going to say that. So what ends up happening is if you want to compete for a quote-unquote great salesperson, you have to pay them what someone else would pay them to sell the thing that made them great. So now you're spending like top dollar to pay someone for the opportunity cost, or sorry, not for the opportunity cost, but there's that opportunity cost inherent in hiring them that, like, what if they're not good at selling the thing that you need them to sell?
Right.
You still have to pay the rate that they would get if they continue to do the other thing. And so it's a really high risk, expensive proposition. And I just found that I was able to do it well myself. So during that time, I not only kind of was doing it, but there were more and more companies that were interested in advertising with us. And I learned how to do the reporting as well as I could do it, the customer service as good as we can do it. And of course, you know, work with the hosts on doing the best reads possible. And it turned out that the things that we offered advertisers separate just from the inventory we sold was better than anything else that they had been receiving elsewhere. And so all of a sudden here I am selling ads for Earwolf, and I have advertisers asking me, well, can we buy Nerdist from you? Can we buy Adam Carolla from you? And I was like, no, I don't sell them. And they're like, well, we want you to, because we want the reporting, we want the reads to work better, blah, blah, blah.
Jeff, I have to interrupt. You're already doing something very new that there's like no, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you guys like the first people to kind of do that in that particular media space?
No, we were definitely not the first. You had Libsyn, which is a audio hosting service. They basically were trying to sell ads for shows that they hosted. Mm-hmm. And then Podtrac, which is another company, you know, they were also looking to sell advertising for podcasters. So as far as I know, they were the two companies that were first. And then I think Podcast One started their own sales thing similar to what we did. I think literally the day after we did. Like, I'm not sure about this, but I think like our press release came out on like February 22nd, and theirs came out on February 23rd or the reverse. I don't know, something like that. But no, there wasn't. We were not the first in the sense of like people who were trying to sell ads for shows that they didn't make. But I like to think that we had a bit of a different take on it. And so far, so good. So we started doing that, and eventually, like I said, I stopped making it about me selling the ads and instead tried to turn it into a business, and that's what Midroll was.
I see.
We launched Midroll April 1st, 2013 was the first day we actually, like, you know, had ads for sale that were not Earwolf. And we've been kind of going strong now almost for 2 years.
Right.
Since then. And so that company was separate. And then at the end of 2013, the Earwolf and Midroll were merged and became something called Midroll Media, where Midroll is the ad arm and Earwolf was the comedy podcasting brand. We've since added Wolf Pop, which is a pop culture channel.
Right.
And all of these things are under the umbrella of Midroll Media. And in on June 1st, 2014, I became chairman and was replaced by Adam Sachs, who became CEO. And as, on August 7th, I essentially retired. I became what's called non-executive chairman, which basically means I spend one day a month with Adam offsite, talking through any high-level issues that he wants to talk to me about, any kind of historical information he needs, any guidance he might want, in addition to spending a couple hours going through like monthly performance reports.
And also getting, you know, back rubs while you guys are contemplating big picture stuff, right? I think I heard you mention that before.
It's typically more like reflexology, which is usually like hands and feet. But yeah, you're right. Yeah.
All right. So thank you for clarifying that, Jeff. And yeah, it's it's very much you know, very much a. It seems like you kind of took over this arena whenever you and Scott Aukerman first started out with Earwolf. You guys focused on great content and developed this amazing network. And that's what's really interesting to me too, because as skateboarders and people that really enjoy fresh, you know, evergreen content. It seems like comedy and skateboarders have that in common. And there's a lot of skateboard podcasts that are popping up now because people are just discovering it. A lot of, you know, very popular shows are basically, you know, letting people know that podcasting is out there. The mobile devices, all the
technologies,
all the things in the cars.
Right.
Where do you see podcasting going now that all of these, now that it's becoming a little bit more mainstream, or do you even see it that way?
I mean, it definitely feels like there's been a bit of a chasm jumped, you know. We've made it to this place where, you know, it's very anecdotal, of course. These things usually are. But I was in Elgin, Illinois over the holidays visiting my in-laws, and I had a emergency dental thing happen. So I had to go in and see this dentist in St. Charles, Illinois. And this guy, you know, he's like probably 70. And he asked me what I did for a living, and all I said was like, oh, I'm in podcasting. Usually that's enough to like shut people up, and then they, you know, they don't pursue it after that. Because no one, I hate trying to explain what we do.
Right.
And so this guy's like, oh yeah, I listened to my first podcast last night. And I was like, there you go. Here we are. You know, like if my 70-year-old dentist in St. Charles, Illinois, listened to his first podcast last night, like, we've made it as an industry. Now, of course, like I said, that's very anecdotal, and the sociologists would kill me for suggesting that that is a meaningful data point. But I think that with Serial, there's a lot of people who just never listened to podcasts before are now listening. And I personally think that, like, the next 6 to 12 months is when we're going to actually see the Serial effect. Mm-hmm. It just ended recently, and all of the data that I've ever seen from our listenerships, whether it be from Earwolf specifically or all of our mid-roll shows, I mean, we've had over, I think, like 400,000 or 500,000 responses to our survey now. Wow. It shows that people who listen to podcasts, it runs deep. You know, I think it's like 36% of the people who responded to the survey listen to at least 11 hours or more a week of podcasts.
That's awesome.
And like 34% had subscribed to 11 or more shows. And so to me, you have all these people who are just now listening to Serial, and a third of them have 10 more podcasts to discover. Mm-hmm. And that probably hasn't fully happened yet. So I think that you're going to see a lot of growth in the space just from the residual, what I'm calling the Serial effect, over the next 6 to 12 months. And I do think that we've hit some sort of a comfort where it's no longer like insane for someone to say that they listen to podcasts. And now, like, if I tell people I'm in podcasting, you know, I have a 40% chance that they know exactly what I mean rather than an 8% chance, which is what it would have been a year ago.
Right.
So I think the future is bright, although I'm with some of the other people that I've read have commented. You know, for the old podcasters or people who've been doing it for a little while, there seems to be a bit of a chip on the shoulder that, like, we've been fine this whole time. We've been growing. Like, we didn't need Serial to kind of, like, make our industry. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think that it has been slowly growing over 10 years. Our data shows that just over the last almost 5. But I do think that something has happened because of Serial that is supercharging the interest in the space. So I'm definitely bullish, but I'm not a big, like, lightning in a bottle kind of guy. I don't think that this changes everything forever, just like I don't think that you're going to have like some day when all of a sudden everyone's listening to podcasts in their cars. I've never bought into that. You can listen to me bitch about it on the Wolf Den. You're talking about, you know, dozens and dozens of car manufacturers that all have their own timeline for how they're going to introduce different technology to making that more ubiquitous. And the reality is that most people have the Bluetooth availability in their vehicles right now.
Right.
So I think that over time, there will be more consumption based in your car. And I think that the car manufacturers will ultimately make that easier for people to do. But I don't buy into this like big bang, like, oh, in 3 years, everything's going to change and there's going to be no such thing as radio anymore and all of that stuff. I'm really not into it. I think you're going to keep seeing the slow, steady push, and it's going to be more driven by content than anything else, which is why Serial was so successful.
I totally agree. And I think that there's going to be a few of these different things that are going to propel it in its own way. The cars, the different apps that might come out in the future that are geared towards podcasting, or maybe even just the networks that are popping up. It seems like, like you mentioned, the new network that Paul Scheer is doing, it's Wolf Pop, right?
Correct.
And there's a lot of networks that are springing up that are geared towards their specific thing. Do you feel like that's contributing in any way, or I guess does that seem like a trend to you?
I'll tell you what I told Adam, our CEO. You know, I think that 2015, if you want to look at things in calendar years, even though business doesn't work that way, it's a lot of great things are going to happen for podcasting. The number one risk that I see, and I guarantee you the whole world could listen to this and they're still going to make this mistake, is there's going to be way too much mediocre or worse content created this year. And everybody is kind of, like I said, buzzing about it, realizing like, hey, I'm a skateboarder who has a fan base, and this is a way for me to reach my fans, so I'm going to start a podcast. And maybe 3 out of those 10 are actually good, and 3 of them are probably terrible, and 4 of them are going to be okay. And I think that the more and more attention the space gets, people realize that it's something that's doable for most people. I think you're going to see a lot of content created, and same as everything. It's going to be like to compare our space to like what happened with YouTube is not crazy. It's just more and more is created constantly, and it just becomes a challenge of figuring out what's worth your attention.
So you guys came out with a lot of really great content that, at Earwolf, you and Scott seem to come out with very creative comedy shows, and the focus on the quality seemed to be there. And you mentioned in other interviews that you guys curated that very carefully. Do you feel like that's difficult to do for one person if they're starting a podcast? Like, what do you think went into that?
I mean, that's a big question, and I'm not trying to get people to listen to my podcast, I swear to God, but there's like 60 episodes of trying to kind of like explain that, you know?
Right.
And there's not like one answer, because things kind of, you're always adapting. I mean, here's the thing. When you don't do well at something, everybody remembers all the things that caused you to fail, and they usually forget the couple things you did right. And when you're successful at something, people tend to remember all the things that you did right and forget all the things that you did to fuck up. And I think that we're lucky in that we're in the latter camp. But I mean, you know, Scott and I, but more driven by me than Scott, we decided to go into a whole like non-comedy push like 2 years ago. And we produced a ton of shows all at once that we released that were not from like our typical comedy background. And we did not succeed. We, you know, most of those shows were not well listened to. And, you know, I think that the reason I'm bringing this up is just that it's nice of you to say, and we did work really hard to have a consistent aesthetic to ensure that if you listened to one of our shows, you knew a certain quality was going to be there. You knew a certain style would be there. But at the same time, every show was unique and had its own point of view and its own voice. But we made mistakes. Like I said, much more myself than Scott, but we made mistakes, and I think you just have to learn from them and make sure you don't repeat them. Is essentially what I learned from that. But to answer your question, it's really hard. It's really hard for anybody or any group of people to come up with a content vision that's going to consistently resonate with a large amount of people. And you do the best you can. You know, you sit down and you figure out what you think. And, you know, for us, it was, what do we like?
Right.
And it's a lot easier. Like, you'd much rather fail making something that you want to listen to than trying to, like, imagine what other people would want to listen to and then failing that way. That's a terrible way to fail. So, you know, Scott has his connections. He had his friends. I knew a few people myself. And, you know, we stuck to kind of the what and the who we know. I mean, the truth is, and this is something that I hate telling because it's kind of depressing for people who aren't friends with Scott, but Scott's a genius. I mean, he's a fucking genius. And he understands entertainment and how to structure entertainment better than, like, almost anybody on the planet. You know, there's, like, a handful of people who are as good at this as Scott is. And so that really was the key determining factor. You know, I was great for, like, hey, Scott, what do you think about this? And he would be like, oh, yeah, that's a cool idea. And then we'd bring somebody in the studio and we'd record a pilot. And then Scott would send, like, a 3-page email, which is essentially, like, a masterclass in entertainment structure, to the host, saying, like, okay, well, here's what was good, here what was bad. And I would do the same thing, but instead of 3 pages, mine was like a paragraph. And only like half of what I wrote did Scott agree with. So I really can't take much of the credit at all on that end. I think I was just really lucky to pick Scott as a partner.
Awesome. Yeah. And it seems like you guys definitely worked well together. I don't know if the Seth Godin startup school was included in that batch of what you would consider not as not to the core, I guess, of Earwolf. But that podcast helped me a lot. I really enjoyed that one.
Oh, good. Yeah, that one is kind of an outlier. You know, I had met Seth several months before that. And then he posted on his blog that he wanted to do audio for this event he was doing, and so I immediately sent him an email pitching him on working with us to do that, and so I convinced him to give us a try, and I gotta tell you, that was a lot of work, but it was worth it. I personally listened to 27 hours of live audio, and I had to listen to all of it and turn it into like the 6 hours that you listen to now. And it took me 80 hours of listening to put it all together. It was exhausting, but it was fun.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
I'm proud of that. That's the only show that I've ever produced in that kind of like full on capacity.
Well, that show actually, I mean, I was working retail at the time when I was listening to that show, and I was plotting and scheming, you know, my business plans and trying to just, you know, make my way as far as like figuring out what I wanted to do and all of that. And that show was very instrumental in me starting what I started. And so it was a huge help to me. So thank you for that. And for Seth.
Yeah, no, Seth is the genius. I think the consistent thing here is that I'm able to weasel my way in with geniuses is essentially my big secret.
Okay. Well, all right. I have a few more questions for you, Jeff, and thank you so much for your time. Do we have time for a few more?
Sure.
All right. So what problems do you face every day that no one else has solved yet?
You mean in the podcasting space or just like...
podcasting or business or life, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think anyone who's ever gone to a doctor's office has felt the pain of a broken system where, you know, anything from minor inconvenience of spending 20 minutes filling out the same information on every piece of paper 12 times at every single time you go to any doctor, to having extremely valid insurance claims rejected and feeling like, not only feeling like, having no recourse to do anything about it. You know, I just feel like the entire healthcare industry is just so fucked and so broken. And it's such, there's so, like the word helpless is the word that I always kind of resonates with me, where people just don't know, like, what do I do? And for the most part, like, the richest people in the world are not in a position to take down an insurance company. You know, this isn't the kind of thing where if you're like the big swinging dick and they screwed up your dry cleaning, you can like get them to fix it no matter what. Like, you're, no matter who you are, you're part of a system that you probably have no control over. And it's, on top of that, it's like the focus on dealing only with things at, when they're at their worst, instead of preventing anything at all from going wrong. So in terms of problems in my life that haven't been solved yet, it's definitely healthcare. And my personal opinion is that someone's going to have to start a legitimate insurance company that doesn't behave the way the current insurance companies do. Because right now, all the innovation I see in the healthcare space is trying to do it around the insurance companies. It's like, right, well, we're going to try and do this thing, and if we can work around the insurance company, or if we can get them to ignore us, then we might actually make something better. I don't personally, like, the insurance companies are the ones that are running healthcare. So anything you want to do outside of them, I think, is going to be a hard thing to scale. So one of the things that I've been thinking about is, like, how do you disrupt the insurance world? And I don't have an answer yet, or at least none that I should speak about publicly, but it's something that something I'm thinking about, and I have a couple ideas, but it's depressing. It really is. Like,
you would have a lot of supporters in your corner if you took on that juggernaut. I mean, it seems like, yeah, it would take something very huge, like Google or Microsoft would have to get involved and try to bully some insurance companies around to get any kind of progress. But,
well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think you can do that. I think you ultimately have to just create an alternative that doesn't behave the way. If I gave you the exact same level of coverage and treat, you know, if I gave you the same coverage for the same price and I accepted and or paid out or denied all the claims just like anyone else would, but I made it easier for you to understand why and what was happening, that alone would make people feel much better. And what I'm talking about is not only doing that, but doing a better job of helping people be healthy rather than finding reasons to prevent them from being healthy. So anyways, I just think that it's not about taking on an insurance company, because that's to me a losing battle. It's, you'd have to create a sustainable alternative that can be scaled. And that's the key.
Well, you definitely did that when it comes to mid-roll and buying advertising from you guys. It seems like, that might be something that you can definitely take on as well, as far as that challenge anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So I have another question, because it kind of has to do with that also. Whenever you mentioned in another interview about the Eardrop app, you mentioned that it was a good idea at the time, and you just had a bunch of good ideas that you couldn't necessarily, stick with all of them. Do you still think that's a good idea?
I do. I still think it's a good idea. I guess I'm probably wrong, or it would have been done by now. You know, we met a couple guys, actually, who did something almost the exact same thing a year ago. I met them. They wanted to talk about partnering with us, and they didn't even know. They didn't even know that Eardrop existed. They were just like looking for us to work with them as comedians. And we talked to them, and ultimately we decided not to partner with them, although they're great guys, but because, yeah, we couldn't afford the distraction.
Right.
But, you know, I'm surprised that nothing's been done there yet, and I still wish that someday that can become a priority for us, although we've got so many things right now going on that it certainly is not going to be this year. But, you know, I still think it's a cool concept. I still remember, you know, we had an old crappy TV installed on our wall, the old studios, and it monitored in real time all of the hits to every file on Eardrop. And so we installed I had them put in like this handheld microphone. So basically, like, Jonah Ray would come in to be a guest on Who Charted, and then he'd be like, "Hey, Jonah, grab the mic and do an Eardrop." And so we had this little keyboard, and Jonah would sign into his Twitter account with this little tiny keyboard using the TV, and then he would do a drop, and we would sit there and we would watch his drop get listened to over and over and over again. And it was like this real-time competition. So then, you know, if like Rob Hubel did a drop around the same time, you would see like Rob and Jonah's tweets, you know, Eardrops like competing against each other. It was really exciting, and we had a pretty good amount of momentum in the beginning that if I was better at my job, I think that would have been successful, but I was in over my head in terms of trying to run both a media company and a technology company at the same time, both of them undercapitalized, understaffed. We had the wrong teams to be doing both things, because it's kind of impossible to have one team that's good at doing both of those things. And ultimately, like, it was a failure of execution based on my shortcomings rather than, I think, like a flawed idea.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know if it was that, but you remind me of whenever you speak in interviews, you mention things that remind me a lot about myself whenever I'm trying to get a handle on all these like ideas that I think are really great. And I know that you've recommended that book, Innovator's Dilemma, for that reason. There's just so many really good ideas, so many ideas that could potentially turn into a project or a business or, you know, something like that. It's hard to narrow it down sometimes.
It is, but if you don't, you will not be able to succeed at everything, at least not all at once. So it's hard understanding, A, your own limitations at the time, and then B, what is executable and what isn't. And like I said, like, you know, the good news is that at the end of the day, it's kind of like either you've done good or you haven't. And if you've done good, most people forget about all the things you fucked up on. At least that's been my experience. All I do is think about all the failures. You know, I don't think about what I did right. I'm just like, man, I will always regret what happened with Eardrop. But, you know, that's just kind of like the way I am, I guess. But and actually, we should cut this piece about what I'm about to say and put it in the beginning, because most people probably don't know what Eardrop is. Eardrop was an iPhone app that connected to your Twitter account that allowed you to leave 13-second long audio messages for your Twitter followers. And that was something that we tried to essentially turn into its own product.
Right. And I remember you talking about that, and I got so excited because in my mind I was just thinking, oh, this is what skateboarding needs. I feel like skateboarding would take hold of this, because there's a lot of engagement when it comes to Instagram, and I feel like if maybe the right people were involved with it, who knows? Who knows what could happen? But yeah, that was my little sneaky way of asking if it was if it was still a good idea and if someone should do it.
You know, I do, but I have to say, as much as I believe in audio, it's very different than anything that's visual, and it's got that's a good thing and a bad thing. in one way, you're much more invested and much more engaged with audio than you typically are with non-audio. And because of that, you know, the people who listen to you, they're real. They care deeply about what you have to say. On the flip side, it's much harder to get people to invest in it as a consumer. You're requiring an extra click. You know, when you're on your Instagram account, you're just flipping, you know, you're just scrolling over and over and over, and then you'll stop it when something looks interesting. You'll consume everything in a short amount of time and then off you go. You can't do that with an eardrop. Right. And because of that, you know, I don't think it would ever quite take on the type of like importance in a social media sense as anything that is visual. But I do think that it could have been much more successful than it was.
Fair enough. All right. And before you go, thank you so much. You've been a really a big help to us, you know, even indirectly before calling, which wanted to get a little bit more advice from you before you leave. So if you can say something to someone that's also trying to bootstrap their own company, maybe in an industry where there's no like definitive products or a blueprint, kind of like what you had or what you didn't have, what advice could you give to them?
Well, I think I wish I could give you something original, but it's really like standard stuff, you know, scratch your own itch. Like if you're part of a community and you have a problem that isn't being solved, then call up a few of your buddies and ask them, hey, if somebody solved this problem, would that be interesting to you? And listen very carefully what they have to say. And if it seems like something that it's, you know, more than just you would want to have solved, then maybe you start to try to figure that out. And when you start trying to solve a problem, you know, I'm a big believer in kind of like the lean startup mentality, where you do just enough to get enough information to figure out what the next step is to take. I've seen so many smart people have great ideas with great plans and put a lot of time and money into something, and it just never gets finished because they're waiting for perfection. And the longer you wait, the more you think everyone will expect perfection. So somebody who's like, oh, I'm going to launch this website in a year, which, by the way, a year, like, if you can't do it in 2 weeks, like, there's something wrong with you. Right. But if they say, oh, I'm going to launch this thing in a year, and then it's coming up on a year, they're going to look at it and be like, well, this thing doesn't look exactly right, and that one feature we wanted isn't there yet. What is it going to look like to everybody if it took me a year to get this thing done and it's not even finished? I'm just going to push the date by a month. And the next thing you know, you're never launching anything. So I definitely think that you have to leave your ego at the door. You have to be prepared to accept that the thing that you're putting into the world is not going to be perfect, but it doesn't have to be. If it resonates with enough people, then they will give you the proper feedback to help you make it better, and you go from there. But number one, scratch your own itch. Trying to solve someone else's problem because you think there's money there is like the worst way to spend your time. It's really unlikely you're going to be successful. And like I said, even if you're not successful, you're going to fail at trying to do something that you didn't even give a shit about. Like, who wants to fail doing that, you know? Right. So there's that. Start small, go fast, keep learning over and over again. And I guess if I were trying to really kind of make it simple, the last piece of advice I would give is to just always be sustainable. You know, people who think that they can figure out a way to make money later tend to go broke and run out of people to borrow money from first, you know. The best thing I ever did with Earwolf was make sure that there was nothing that was a good, there was no reason good enough to spend more money than we had ever, period, never. And to this day, that serves us well. We're able to control our own destiny. We never have to, we have no outside investors. We have no debt and we have no one to tell us how to run our business. No one saying, hey, nobody's listening to that show, you should cancel it. Now, that doesn't mean we can't cancel it because no one's listening. But if we do, it's our own decision, not because some investor doesn't understand the genius of the Hollywood Handbook. And so, you know, I think that considering like sustainability as one of your most important goals, again, I'm very biased because this is how I did it and it worked for me. There's a lot of ways to build a business. And if you want to build something massive fast, you know, you're going to probably need funding. But I prefer to do things a little bit more measured and a lot more sustainable so that you're never making decisions that don't feel good. There's nothing worse than being in a position where you got to do something that doesn't really feel all that great, because if you don't, somebody's going to take away your thing. And so there you have it.
Man, that is amazing, actionable advice right there, Jeff. And I tend to agree. I share that opinion that if you want it done the right way and, you know, you want to do it yourself without any strings attached or people telling you what to do.
Yeah, it's
definitely
really,
get some customers first.
It's really funny that you say that, Jeff, because it's just like my brother talking to us during our meetings. You know,
when we read the same books, I think.
Yeah. I was like, man, we got to get an investor to help us start our company. And he just beat me up day in and day out. Like, no, we could do this ourselves and sustain this.
Yeah. So that makes me feel really good to hear that, Jeff. And
one last thing I'll say about that. Even if you do go get funding, you know, just do something on your own for 3 months, for 6 months. Mm-hmm. If you can prove that you can execute on any level, solving any kind of problem that has a shot at being beyond you, and do it in a sustainable way, the value that you can charge to borrow, you know, the cost of the money just went down by 50%.
Right.
Your access to that money just doubled. And so even if your plan is to have someone step in and help you fund something to grow fast, I still beg people, like, just put in that first amount of work, and that amount of work will pay you off in spades down the road when you look at your cap table, versus if you don't do it when you have no leg to stand on and you got to give away such a much larger piece of your business because of it.
Totally true. Man, thank you so much, Jeff. You know, we really wanted to have you on the show to talk to our audience and give them these great tips and all this awesome advice, and you've really done that, so thank you. And if you wanted to hear more of Jeff and his podcast, please listen to it on earwolf.com. It's called The Wolf Den. And Jeff, for our audience, can you tell us where we can find you online? And
so you can follow me at Jeff Ulrich with two L's on Twitter, and that's the best place to find me and interact with me.
And again, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch, Jeff.
It was
thank
awesome
you so much.
To have you on, brother.
No problem. Take care, guys. Thanks
care,
so much.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Did you enjoy the episode? Don't forget to subscribe, give us a 5-star rating and a quick review in iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at Skate2CreatePodcast. And stay connected via Twitter at Skate_2_create. See you at the next session.